I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Corinne Kratz. She's a cultural anthropologist, professor of cultural anthropology and African studies at Emory University. And tonight she will be giving a lecture called The Case of the Recurring Wodabe. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm delighted to be here.
So who are the Wodabe people?
The Wodabe people live in West Africa. Most of them live in Niger. They are a pastoralist group, so they have, you know, large herds of longhorned cattle. They've got some camels. They've got goats and donkeys, and they're basically sort of nomadic pastoralists living in the Sahelian region of West Africa.
And one thing that is interesting about them, besides who they are and the way they live, is that they're really beautiful people. And mm-hmm. so many Westerners, Europeans, Americans, whatever, have gone with their cameras and their film cameras and so on and documented them. And that has become that's become the focus of your work.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually, they are beautiful people, but and beauty and the cultivation of beauty is something that is highly valued by the Wodabe. It's a very particular kind of occasion that has attracted all of the photographic attention and the filmic attention, and it's particularly a couple of kinds of dances that the Wodabe do during the rainy seasons. I mean, living in the Sahel, most of the year when it's dry, they are dispersed into small lineage groups, basically looking for forage for their herds. But when the rains come and the grass grows, they can gather into sort of multi-lineage gatherings, and they celebrate a lot of things. They celebrate births, they celebrate marriages. And they have these visually spectacular dances where the young men in particular paint their faces and put on, you know, marvelous costumes, and dance and sing, and it's a competitive dance between lineages. And three of them are selected to choose the man who is the most beautiful of the dancers, and that's the thing that has attracted this, you know, just an amazing amount of attention in the last. Basically, since starting in about 1950, and what I've been doing is actually tracing the history of those images, because before 1950, these images were not circulating in the larger world. And if you think about them now, I mean, I can't show anything because we're on the radio.
Right, right.
But
I can guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, that you've seen some of these images because they're very famous.
Absolutely, and they're everywhere.
While you're listening, turn on your computer and Google Wodabe.
I mean, there have been over nearly 20 films made about the Wodabe. There have been coffee table books of, you know, marvelous pictures. And that actually was the puzzle for me when I started to pay attention to the Wodabe, to say, why is there so much about the Wodabe? How did these images get everywhere?
Now, before 1950, there were images, but they just weren't circulated. They sort of hadn't caught on yet.
Exactly. They hadn't caught on yet. And, I mean, I found very, very few images. So if there are images from, the early part of the 20th century, you know, they're in people's private albums or something like that. I mean, I even, when I was doing the research for this project, I have a couple of colleagues who are historians of stereographs of African peoples, and one who is a scholar who has, you know, done lots of things, written a couple of books on the history of postcards of Africa. And I asked them, and, you know, they said, Tuareg, we get Tuareg, you know, we get Maasai, we get Zulu, but Wodabe, no, really not. And at one point, there are these online auction sites for historic postcards. I followed them for a couple of months, and I did actually find two, But the number of images before 1950 were, you know, few and far between, and they certainly weren't circulating then.
And what happened? I mean, what was it? Was it something in the kind of post-war American and European consciousness that was attracted to that?
Well, it's a very complicated story. That's actually the story of the lecture. That's, you know, the entire thing is going to basically trace what happened between 1950 and now. And it's, you know, it's a complicated conjunction of attention from researchers, from filmmakers, and how that intersects with a kind of receptive imaginary that we have, Euro-Americans have, and how we think about African peoples and pastoralists and nomads. So it's the story of that intersection, and how and when it just kind of took off that I'm really tracing in the course of the talk.
There must also be something in there psychologically about, first of all, the competition, the dance competition, but also this, like, the ladies get to choose who's the nicest guy. That's also something that sparks people's imagination.
Exactly. And actually, as I trace the history of the images and the interpretations of the images, one thing that happens is that there's a certain point where the gender readings are shifted and come forward.
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that there's a time when, this is particularly after, I think when Werner Herzog's film, Herdsman of the Sun, came out. If you look at some of the reviews of that and some of the ways that it was marketed, people, we look at these images and we think they're cross-dressing. They're not, as far as they're concerned. But to our eyes, there's gender ambiguity when you look at the images, you know, sort of isolated from other contexts. And it's like, well, you know, what am I looking at? And I think that really got into a lot of the reason why they spread so far and so quickly at that time. There were some situations. I was in Chicago in 1990 or 1991, and I saw Herzog's film playing as a double feature with Paris is Burning, you know, which was a film at the time about transvestite competitions in New York.
Right.
So there was definitely a gender spin, and it's often portrayed in Europe and in the U.S. as if there's a gender inversion here. And, you know, the dances are compared to our beauty pageants.
And meanwhile, there are the Wahdabi people living their lives, probably going through the same changes that everybody in Africa is going through as the world modernizes around them. But unlike maybe everyone but the Maasai, perhaps, people are paying so much attention to them. I mean, what is it like for them? Oh, here comes Time Magazine. Here comes The Anthropologist. Here comes Werner Herzog.
Exactly. And, the Wahdabe, this is another strand that I'll talk about, but the Wahdabe performances have also transformed. So, you know, they now, they go to Europe and perform. They've performed worldwide. And this has the kind of organization of those tours has changed over time, particularly in the last sort of 10 to 15 years, as Wahdabe, and it's young men who are doing these dances, they began to organize themselves into lineage organizations, or there's now a grand assembly, to take more control of their work conditions. Because there was a time when they were they'd be called to go perform in Europe, and they would not have rights to their images, and
yes.
You know, they would basically they would sell crafts on the side, and that was the main way that they were making money from the performances. So they began to, you know, organize themselves and you know, take more control of the work conditions, but. I don't have any figures, but I think that it's probably the popularity of the Wahdabe dances and images has done a lot for Nigerian tourism, for sure.
Right, right. We're talking to cultural anthropologist Corinne Kratz. What is your relationship with the Wadabi people?
My relationship with the Wadabi is through literature and film alone.
Oh, okay.
I'm an anthropologist who most of my research has been in Kenya, and I've also worked in South Africa with many colleagues in South Africa with an exchange program focused on museums and public history. But the connection here is that the broader issues in the representations of the Wadabe and the circulation of the images are the same broad issues that I've been working on. I was 20 or something, so you know, almost 40 years now. Because my research was my main research has been in Kenya with a minority group called the Okiek, who are hunter-gatherers who live next door to the Maasai. And so I've done a lot of work trying to think through how it is that stereotypes are formed, how they're perpetuated, because the Okiek are basically looked down upon by most people of Kenya. Some people, they're also called the Dorobo, which means poor people without cattle, which is a name that the Maasai would use for them.
Right.
You know, I've paid attention to how images and representations of minority groups, representations of Africa and Africans, have been made, how they've been understood in the U.S. and in Europe, and how they've circulated and been perpetuated. So I've been working on that for a long time, and my main work is basically on culture and communication of all sorts, whether it's visual or verbal. And the Wadabe were basically another case of this. And I noticed them because I was living in Kenya during the 80s. And the Carol Beckwith's book, Nomads of Niger, came out. And, you know, it was tremendously popular there. And her first book had been, this beautiful picture book called Maasai, which, of course, working next to Maasai, I knew, and so I paid attention to that. And I moved back to the States in 1990, and that was when I noticed, you know, there was the Herzog film was in circulation then. There were a couple of other films about the Wadabi, and that was when I first said, what's going on? Why is all this stuff about the Wadabi? What's happening? And that's, so, the case of the recurring Wadabe is both a kind of, it's been a puzzle for me of, in this sort of Sherlock Holmes way of, you know, why this attention?
Did you figure it out?
I did, in a general way. What happened as I, it was a puzzle for me for decades. And I used to, play like three or four of the films together. I would teach a course on African popular culture, and I would play. You know, we'd have movie night with the students, and you know, we'd look at all of the films over the course of a couple of nights, which was a great way to teach students the role of editing and perspective when you look at films on the same thing. And you know, that was basically, you know, it was just kind of a puzzle to me. And then a couple of years ago, I said, well, let me try to figure this out. And that's when the sense of the case of the recurring Wadabe turned into a case in the sense of, let me look at this as a model for how these processes work.
So what, I mean, jumping to the conclusions, what did you come up with? Why are those images so attractive to Westerners, to Europeans and Americans, and how has that attraction to those images changed since 1950?
Well, I mean, what I decided was that the Wadabi are a really interesting case because it happened over a relatively short period of time. But the case of the Wadabi that I look at is basically the same thing that has happened with the Zulu, with the Maasai, and, you know, I'm an Africanist, so I take African cases, but, you know, with sort of ethnic and minority groups, you know, all over the world. And, you know, I'm basically sort of looking at what the process is of how that works. And you know, without going into the entire lecture, I kind of break the process down into certain kinds of structures, certain kinds of opportunities and historical and cultural factors that come together that enable it. And then, you know, there's some kind of a spark. It can be something visual, it can be an event, but something happens that will kind of propel the images out.
But what, I mean,
in this,
you're
in
not
this
answering
case,
my question.
Well, I'm answering it in a general way.
No, I mean, what yeah. is it? What is it about those people that attracts us? Is it just the beauty? Is it the gender thing? I mean,
it's the beauty. It's the gender thing. It's the fact that they're nomads. You know, because we have had, you know, a long romance with the figure of the nomad. It's a kind of imagination of imagination of cultural identity and cultural difference that and you know, the nomad can be, you know, the kind of romantic you know, sort of free figure. And you know, Wahdabe are in some ways, you know, the most nomad of nomad when in the way that they're presented and you know, in the way that they live. So I mean, there's a whole series of things that come together. There's not a single answer.
Corinne Kratz is a cultural anthropologist. She teaches cultural anthropology and African studies at Emory University. And her lecture tonight is called The Case of the Recurring Wahdabe. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. If people want to head over there, make sure to use the Washington Avenue entrance. Thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.